Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter with hashtag InforumSF. I'm Brad Stone, Senior Technology Writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Tonight we are joined by Laszlo Bock and George Anders. Laszlo serves as Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google. During his tenure, he has led Google's growth from 3,000 to more than 32,000 employees, all while helping to keep Google atop of the best places to work lists year after year. George Anders is a New York Times best-selling author and a journalist with 3 decades of writing experience and a Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a 1997 team piece at the Wall Street Journal. He has covered everything from finance and high tech to high stakes poker. He is also the author of 4 books, including The Rare Find, which will be available during tonight's reception. They are here to talk to us about finding great talent, the philosophy of work, and more. So to start things off, I feel like I'm hearing in Silicon Valley these days the phrase A players. You hear, I want to join a company with A players, so I'm joining a company and I want to get rid of the B players and the C players. How much merit? It's like we all have baseball cards with our stats on the back. How much merit do these distinctions have? Are they real? Are they something that you use at Google, Laszlo?
Well, thanks, Brad. Within Google, we actually don't categorize people A, B, C, high potential, not, because in every company will tell you this. We only hire A players, right? The reality is we invest a lot of time and energy in making sure the people we do hire hit a very, very high bar. And in fact, the mistake we probably make is we don't hire enough of the people who would probably do well, and we pass them over. But once they're in, we manage performance and so on, but we don't really draw a distinction because we think, you know, if you get the front part, the recruiting part right, and build a population of great people, you know, it's not actually that helpful to then sort of micro-segment them into, you're great, you're mediocre, you're terrible.
George, are those phrases that you heard in researching The Rare Find, and do you think they're useful for companies?
I heard it a lot, and I think it's actually something that can take you down the wrong road, that there are an awful lot more people who are capable of doing A work than those kinds of systems tend to allow. And often they get used by organizations that get a little bit hazy or sloppy about defining the job at hand and try and make up for lack of clarity on the front end by setting very tight standards for who they're going to take. And you know, the 3.7 grade points aren't good enough, you got to get the 3.9s. The people with 5 years of experience aren't good enough, you need 9 years of experience. And an effort to sort of solve the problem on the spec side that you never really solved on the matching the person to the job. So, you know, one of the places that loved to hire A players was Enron. And I think that can become a path toward, you know, a cult of superficial achievement rather than an ability to match people to the job at hand.
Of course, everybody probably thinks they're an A player.
Just haven't found their game yet.
Laszlo, people want to hear, obviously, a lot about hiring at Google. You joined in 2006. The company was 3,000 people. What did you find? What were the hiring practices back then?
What's interesting is some of the core principles that we have today still existed back then, and they'd been set very early on by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders. One of the principles was hiring managers actually don't make hiring decisions. Because the problem you have with companies is, first of all, as a hiring manager, when you're trying to make a hire, you're really exacting about the quality of person you hire for the first month or two. But 6 or 9 months out, you'll take anybody with a pulse, and they didn't want to have that happen. And you see that a lot in startups. So hiring decisions are actually not made by hiring managers. They're made by committees. And then there's review at different levels, culminating actually in Larry Page, who still reviews every offer we make. There's a number of other things. We gather lots and lots of different data points of feedback. So we don't just rely on interview feedback. We do internal references, external references. And we try to have as broad a view of the individual as possible. And then the last thing is, there was always a sense of we might be missing someone great. And one of the things we've actually put a lot of effort into over the intervening years is how do we get better at finding the people we might otherwise miss? particularly people who come from a background that is not the sort of, you know, the historic top grades, top Ivy League kind of background, and how do we get the best people no matter what their background?
So you're talking about consistency, but a lot has changed, no doubt. I mean, you guys hired almost 8,000 people last year, so how do you scale your organization?
We make a big, big investment in terms of headcount and time spent on hiring. Some of it just isn't compressible. I mean, we looked at all kinds of different analytics you can do and different ways of looking at it. And for example, one of the things we've done is, at Google, we care a lot about hiring smart people. And the idea is that's actually more important than people who have done that specific job before. Because a bright person, they'll figure it out and get it 80% right, and they're likely to come up with something new. So we focus a lot on that. And the way we've scaled that is, when the company was very small, it was easy to just go to 10 different schools. We didn't need to hire that many people. As we've gotten bigger, we actually get applications and hire from over 800 different schools around the world today. And you can't just limit your population to a small set. So we built some pretty rigorous processes around how do you assess cognitive ability. And one of them is we have a central team now that part of their work is exclusively do these assessments. And they're calibrated, and they let everybody else know. And if they say we should hire somebody, that's good enough.
George, in the rare find, you write about Google, particularly in the introduction. Tell us that story of that key moment in Google's history where they started to evaluate some of the priorities and really reprioritize them.
Yeah, so this actually builds off of some of what Laszlo was just telling you, that I always think of the early Google as the place that really wanted to know your SAT scores. And I think you found that that's of mild interest, but that people sometimes go on to become more than their SAT scores were, or not every person with double or triple 800s turns out to be the perfect hire. So this is the story of Todd Carlyle, who was working for you at the time, I guess still is, and he had hit on the notion of gathering 300 different success markers, Google's wonderfully systematic, and looking to see which of them actually correlated with successful hires. So this ranged everything from, are Eagle Scouts better employees? And the answer is probably not, but not any worse either. Does owning a pet make a difference? Does playing chess make a difference? I think Sergey Brin had pitched in, does getting involved in technology at a very precocious age matter? And surprise, the founder's right. The people who got their first PC at age 9 or 7 or what have you do tend to be more adventurous and better explorers. But when he aggregated everything, he came up with the idea that sometimes you can learn as much by reading the resume upside down as you can from the top down, particularly when, as you mentioned, you're dealing with a pool of very high achievers and trying to draw fine differences between the person who's a 3.8 from Caltech and a 3.7 from Harvard. They're both plenty bright and very capable people. And sometimes it's the extracurriculars, the side interests that demonstrate passion, that demonstrate ingenuity, to demonstrate some of the other traits you could want. So I don't think you use it in every aspect of Google all the time, but it is something that I think still rattles around in some departments and is a way of finding talent that, as you described, you might otherwise overlook.
Well, absolutely, and I'd add that it's not just sometimes the other things make a difference. It's almost every time the other things. We actually at Google, we stopped asking, well, so if I roll the clock back, when the company was small and we had a few people to hire, it was just easy to ask for SAT and GPA and go to 10 schools. If you're hiring, 7,000 or 8,000 people, that's not going to work. And so it also fortunately turns out that data is not actually that helpful. You know, academic research outside of what we've done at Google tells you that, for example, an SAT score is somewhat predictive for someone, how someone's going to do in their career for the first 2 years after graduation at best. But if you look beyond that, it's completely irrelevant. And, normal people know that, right? Like you take a test when you're 16, it's not going to predict what you can do when you're 40 or 50. But at Google, it took us a little longer to figure that out. But now we've got it.
So, George, a lot of companies watch Google very carefully and try to emulate what they do. Has that method spread beyond Google? Do you feel like the old orthodoxy of looking at grades, looking at grade point, academic achievement, has spread beyond, that other companies are starting to reevaluate as well?
I ended up doing a book talk in London, and one of the people attending was a HR consultant, and she loved the idea of reading the resume upside down and has now built a whole module around it. So, we've planted the seed 8 time zones away, and it's spreading. But I think there's something that's both counterintuitive and very compelling about it, that we tend to, if we're getting too rigid, to minimize the impact of all these other factors. And when you stop and think about it, it's usually the people with the most drive and initiative that become your greatest hires. And you can see a lot from, the bottom 10 lines of a resume that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Laszlo, I just want to get back to that startling number, 7,800 people mm-hmm. you hired last year. Tell us about this year and where you're looking at, what you're looking at for growth. Do you think you'll better that? And where are you with regards to your own team and bringing people into your department?
So for Google, I have to be careful because we as a company don't give forward-looking guidance, and so I can't be too specific. Last year was notable because it was one of our biggest hiring years ever. And I think the phrase Larry used in the earnings call was it was at the edge of what is manageable. Basically, we grew the company by 25%. And at that point, it actually gets a little hard to acculturate everybody and make sure they get how the company works and get them up to speed as quickly. So I think I'm safe in saying we're probably not going to beat any records, but we're still hiring thousands and thousands of people all around the world. In people operations, in people operations, we're also hiring as well, but probably fewer than thousands and thousands.
That's incredible. How do you, so you didn't answer part of my question, which is how big your team is, and I can understand that, but let's assume that you have hundreds of people. How do you manage that? How do you grade, your employees when, hiring more people, doing more work is not necessarily a good gauge?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. It's been very different when it's very different leading and managing a group that's 50 people versus 200 people versus hundreds and hundreds of people. The key to managing a large organization, I found, is setting very clear direction, number one. Number two, finding a way to actually measure what people are doing. And I don't mean in sort of, the green eye shade, tick and tie, Frederick Taylor time motion study kind of thing. But trying as much as you can to figure out what are the outputs and are the outputs getting better or worse. And some of those outputs can be soft and squishy like innovation, and you won't have a specific measure. But you'll know this particular team came up with a couple brilliant ideas, and that's good enough. The third thing is, and this echoes how we look at hiring, is taking power away from managers. So a core Google tenet is that there's all kinds of problems with managers. Managers have an incentive. Well, first of all, they could be manipulated. I mean, everyone's been in a situation where you've got a coworker, because it's never me. It's always the other guy who's kissing up and, bad behavior and stealing work. And the manager loves them, and that person gets rewarded. So the way you get to truth and the way you see who's actually performing is the manager becomes a voice in that. But at Google, what we do is we calibrate everyone's performance with groups. So I have a much larger organization now, and we have a series of layers where everybody who is a staffing person, someone on our staffing team, a recruiter, they will get an initial rating from their manager. But then all the managers will sit down and compare notes. And we do that higher and higher through the organization until you get to a big enough group size that the distribution of ratings should kind of make sense, should approximate normal and so on. But what's important is the managers then get to know everybody and say, well, I thought Sally was great, but now that I compare her to Sue in this other division, I actually realize she's not as good and I'm going to lower her rating somewhat. And so by getting that calibration across different managers, you actually get a much more robust sense of what's going on. And we also do a lot of peer feedback. I can talk about that later. But getting input from peers and subordinates actually is a huge input to how we assess people.
George, Google is obviously approaching the significant problem of scaling in a very analytical, googly way. But, how much of the hiring process do you think is subjective? When in the rare find in your research, did you come to any conclusions about the ratio between science and art and subjective decision making in the hiring process?
You run the whole spectrum, and in fact, the revelatory moment for me, I interviewed a art dealer in the morning, and I talked to him about how do you pick the next great artist, and he said, I will ask people, open up your portfolio and surprise me. And then a couple hours later, I was interviewing someone who trains and selects airline pilots. And I realized that he cannot use that method for him. If he says, here's the landing gear, surprise me, that's probably not someone you want flying your plane. So there's a pool of jobs that are very tightly specced and where you really are looking for the same repeatable skills again and again. But if you look at where all the job growth is, it tends to be in that earlier bucket of jobs that do require the unexpected. Criteria that people are looking for, fast learners, because whatever you're doing now, it's going to be different 3, 4, 5 years down the road, and that ability to learn quickly may be more important than any specific skills you have today. I talk a lot in the book about resilience, and it was interesting coming in and looking up on the board. I think you had a couple traits that were very similar to that. how we recover from our setbacks, our mistakes, our strokes of bad fortune, can be as valuable in finding a successful employee as someone who's had nothing but successes, and then, well, when things go wrong, they don't know how to handle them. So I would argue that in a lot of the fields we're most interested in, there's still a big element of art.
So, Laszlo, Google is famous for challenging its prospective employees in very creative ways, brain teasers, and perhaps less so now than in its early years. But take us into the interview room. What is a potential employee likely to face when they walk into a room with you and interview for a job at Google?
Well, it's funny because the brain teasers get a lot of press. They actually don't work. They're not that helpful. They serve primarily to make the interviewer feel clever. And they're great at that. Not so good at assessing people. So we look for four things. And this is true across all our jobs everywhere in the world. Number one, we look for what we call general cognitive ability. Are you a good problem solver? Are you clever? Number two, we look for leadership experience. And we don't mean leadership in the traditional sense. When we look at leadership at Google, it's not were you president of the chess club or how quickly did you make vice president at your company. We look for what we call emergent leadership. So the notion that anytime you're operating in a team environment, you're faced with a problem. And whoever's in charge of that team should be leading. But whoever actually has the skill set to solve that particular problem should step up and should solve the problem and should contribute. And when that problem is resolved, they should step back and let somebody else take the charge. So we look for people who have demonstrated this ability. And we get at it by asking behavioral interview questions. We don't say, are you a good leader? We say, give me an example of a time when you did X, Y, and Z.
Well, can you give us a concrete example of a question you might ask?
So we would, on that dimension, we would ask somebody, give me an example of a time you were working in a team and you were faced with a difficult problem that seemed insoluble. And I don't care whether you solved it or not, but tell me the role you played and how you worked through it. And then the candidate would talk through it, and then you would say, what made you decide to take that course of action? Because then you're digging below just the superficial, here's my canned answer, but you're getting to the thought process. And then the other two things we look for are role-related expertise. As I said, actually knowing how to do the job is the least important factor, and cultural fit. And the main thing we look for there is whether somebody will be comfortable in an environment as ambiguous as Google. And we also look for conscientiousness. Because in an environment where the work is team-based and where you expect people to sort of just step up and become leaders, little flags like, are you the kind of person who, when you walk down the hallway, pick up the garbage on the floor and throw it out? Those are really important. Because we want everyone to think that way. Because that's how an owner thinks versus how an employee thinks.
So if you're interviewing at Google, just clean the place up.
Clean it up. Do not leave your water bottle in the interview room.
George?
I actually want to pick up on something you said. As I talked to other organizations about how they interview, the ones that impress me the most ask a lot of how and why questions. Mm-hmm. The ones that seem stuck with people who never turn out as well as they hoped are asking a lot of what and when. Much more of a sort of month-by-month documentation of the resume as opposed to getting inside thought processes and how you approach problems. So that ability to find character and to understand the inner dynamic that leads people to decisions, the hows and the whys really are the questions that drive that.
Yeah, it gives you a much better sense of how the person thinks and really who they are, right? Because anybody going in an interview, they're already prepared. They're going to tell you how wonderful they are and smart and clever and fast and strong and, you know, all these things. And so you sort of have to find a way to get past that.
George, did you encounter any kind of truly idiosyncratic, bizarre interview rituals in your research? Is any company out there, you know, asking the truly strange brain teaser or doing trust falls or anything like that?
Oh, God, trust falls. Couple companies that intrigued me by what they were looking for. Procter & Gamble is legendary for having this pool of people in the early 80s who leapt up to enormously great positions. Steve Ballmer ended up running Microsoft. Jeff Immelt ran GE. Scott Cook, Intuit, Meg Whitman, eBay, and there are about a dozen more. And they were all sort of brand managers for Pringles and Crisco and the like. And you go, what in the world was P&G doing right there? A lot of what they were looking for at the time was something most companies don't ask for, and that's ability to multitask. And it's not a standard entry-level requirement, but when you think about what makes for great CEOs, they are spectacular multitaskers. They can move from talking about business strategy to sorting out a thorny HR question to reviewing the design of a new product and ad campaign, and that's just the morning. They haven't even got to their afternoon yet. So that ability to look for an unusual virtue there, I think, turned out to be helpful. Linear technology likes people who were tinkerers when they were young. And I ended up talking to them, and they all sort of built diabolical contraptions at age 12 that sort of shocked their sister or, you know, set dogs on fire or did other things. And you go, that's actually the kind of person who's a really good circuit designer. They just like playing with resistors and capacitors and making things. And they're the ones who will stay till 9 or 10 in the evening and do design number 30 to try and solve the problem. And you can't really teach that. Either you love playing with circuits or you don't. And looking for people who've been doing that since childhood, or certainly since adolescence, tended to be a good selector for them.
Laszlo, one of Google's greatest assets in hiring the very best people in its early years was, you know, the stock price, the upside. And now, you know, there are a brighter star. Well, let's say there are companies with potentially more runway ahead or upside, companies that haven't gone public, startups. How do you compete? How do you sweeten Google's offer to the very best who may, you know, be looking for a company that has yet to prove itself?
Well, a couple things. Number one, we actually haven't seen a huge effect from startups or other companies. We'll see occasional blips, but we haven't had anything persist for more than a couple of quarters where something is hot and kind of attracting people and it's an issue. So our win rate when we go head-to-head or when we're hiring, very, very, very strong. So we haven't seen a huge issue on that front. I think part of the reason why is because a lot of private companies now transact shares on private markets. And so, you know, you take a Facebook or LinkedIn before they went public or Zynga before they went public, and you can, as an individual, now transact their shares. So what seems to be happening is they largely get fully valued while they're still private. Employees are able to trade those shares. And yeah, when they go public, you know, if you've watched Groupon and Zynga and these companies, some of them get a pop, some don't. And so the upside people are waiting for doesn't seem to exist in the pre-IPO companies in the same way it did 10 years ago. When they're very, very small, it does. But once they start getting traded on the private markets, they seem to get valued pretty reasonably, and that part of the allure goes away. And then the big discussion candidates will have with us is, really, where am I going to be able to have a bigger impact on the world? And most people so far, when we go head-to-head, conclude that Google's got a big, pretty big footprint, and we're crazy enough to try lots and lots of different things. And, you know, whether you're interested in, you know, wind farms or solar energy or search or social, you know, or autonomous cars, you know, there's something somewhere at Google. So our experience has actually been in the last few years pretty positive.
George, not to create tension on the panel, do we believe Laszlo here? Can Google go head to head with a company like Twitter, you know, a 32,000 person company versus whatever Twitter is now, a 4,000 or 5,000 person company, and you know, where does
I've got an answer that'll torment both Google and Twitter. And this goes back to my first book I wrote about Kolber, Kravis, Roberts, and the rise of private equity and how people could become billionaires by, you know, moving pieces of paper around. And one of the early associates of KKR had a maxim. It came in two parts. And the first was, if you pay somebody enough money, you can get them to do anything. And then the second half was, if you pay them enough money for long enough, you cannot get them to do, and I'm going to paraphrase, anything, although he used a four-letter word that starts with S. And both halves of it are true, that money's a tremendously powerful motivator early, but it is not sustainable. People start to want more and more to feel satisfied, or it just dulls them. So I think if you're a startup, yes, you can pull in some people early with the lure of get rich quick. But over time, you end up with people who are vesting in peace, people who've already hit their number and are just sort of gliding out, and a very transactional kind of employee who's viewing this as, you know, the equivalent of being at the Goldman Sachs trading desk. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think we in the media always find it fascinating how much money you can make at a startup gone right. But to rely on that as your main driver is going to cause you more headaches than success.
Well, and George, that's actually post-IPO what we saw. There was a lot of discussion about, you know, are people going to vest in peace and how do you keep them motivated? And what happened was some people left, some people vested in peace, and we tried to figure out how to work with that. But we talked to the people who stuck around and kept working hard. And what's interesting is there's a person like this on my team, this wonderful, wonderful woman who was Google's first HR person. And she joined, you know, in the first year or two of the company's history, and she's still there 13 years later. And she's representative in the sense of when you talk to her, she says, I'm here because I believe we're doing something that matters. And that I personally, even though my job is different and the company, you know, I was one of 50 people, now I'm one of 32,000, it matters and I'm having an impact. And as long as I feel like I'm having an impact and it matters, I'm going
to
be here.
And we can go all the way back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you're getting to the top of the pyramid
yeah.
then.
And that's why, by the way, Maslow, right? That we feed people, that's not what keeps them, right? it's the very top. Once everybody's paid sort of enough, mm-hmm. it's the stuff at the top that really keeps them, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Laszlo, do you like the acqui-hire model? And that's the idea of acquiring a small startup mm-hmm. for its engineering talent?
It works about 60 or 70% of the time. We do a fair number. Google does, I'm not sure if we've shared the number publicly, but we do quite a few acquisitions. I mean, many, many acquisitions throughout the year. Most of them are companies of 6 to 20 people. And there's years where it's almost one a week, and there's years where it's far fewer than that. And about 70% of the time, when you acquire a company for the talent and not the product, it works out. The rest of the time, it's a little more mixed, and we may have misjudged, they may have misjudged, and it just doesn't work out. It's certainly more expensive than just regular recruiting. Your cost per hire is a lot higher when you're buying a company for $10 million than when you're hiring someone off the street.
You think that's an idea that has gone out of fashion, or you think we'll still see more of them in the years ahead?
Well, I think in the tech industry, there's a bubble. There's a number of different bubbles. There's a lot of money sitting around waiting to be invested, and that's driving up prices. There's a lot of companies, larger companies with cash on their hands saying, well, you know, it used to be expensive to spend $10 or $20 or $50 million. Now it's not because I've got this big pile of cash, so I'm going to do more of these. This drives up the valuations further. So companies are more price indifferent than they used to be, and so I think you'll see more of this stuff. But what I would guess is that over the next 3 to 4 years, most companies will learn that you want to be really thoughtful when you do these. You want to assess not just are these brilliant people, but is it going to be a good fit? And importantly, are you going to have something for them to work on? Because if you don't think those through ahead of time, then you're going to hire or acquire, and they're going to leave. So I think it's going to continue to peak, and then I think it'll drop, because it's actually a lot harder than it looks from the outside.
George, a lot of our listeners today may be looking for a job, unfortunately. So how do they get hired by Google and capture the attention of someone like Laszlo?
So one of the things I've been talking to people about is the sense of you can either drop your resume off in this enormous bin that just gets bigger and bigger. I mean, it's hard to get a job at Google. It's hard to get a job at Starbucks. I think they actually top you. They had 6 million applications last year and hired less than you did, and that's just to pour coffee. Or you can switch the process and try and become someone who becomes found and found before there's official job posting. So I think one of the channels that's opening up is, can you have enough of a presence either through your networking or through what you have up on the web that people will look for you? And I'm finding more recruiters combing through the GitHubs, the Slashdots, and looking to see who is posting a lot, who's making a lot of really intelligent contributions, who's admired as an expert. And then they will come after that person and say, do you want to come work for us? And that's a much better position to be in. An example that I use in the book is the debating champion of the U.S. in college. And champion debaters have a terrible career track because you win awards in college and there's nowhere to go after that. So most of them end up in law school and they don't particularly like it, and they're, stuck in the bowels of a corporate litigation department going, where did I go wrong? And Goodby Silverstein, one of the top ad agencies, not just in San Francisco but in the world, has a partner there who will look for people in unlikely walks of life. And he began saying, where can I find really great researchers? I mean, people who can size up markets and can tell you, this is how many airline seats are sold a year and why people buy seats at the prices they do and what loyalty is determined. And he said, you know what I ought to be doing? I ought to be looking at people who research for a living. So he looked at private investigators who he decided were a little too complicated to bring into the ad agency world. He looked at investigative journalists who generally weren't ready to make the switch or preferred not to. And then he looked at college debaters, and he said, this is a terrific pool of people. They're analytical. They're good at summarizing. They have presenting skills. You can bring them into client meetings. And those ended up being very ingenious hires. But how did he find them? He went on the web and looked to see who had won trophies and who had really interesting modules of, here's how to argue Nietzsche. And the guy who did the Nietzsche resolution is now doing airline market share impact. And in that case, you can map into a career you didn't even know existed because you've established prominence in a related field. So to tie it back to your question, look for a way to become known as an expert in a field that people want to hire in.
Laszlo, again, for our prospective job candidates, what skills have more value going forward?
At Google or generally speaking?
Maybe both.
Well, I think when people think about Google, they typically think it's a company of engineers. Only half of Google are engineers. The other half are salespeople and finance people, people operations folks, communications folks, marketers. So we actually look for all kinds of skills. It's funny. The best way to sort of get into a place like Google is, you know, certainly be good at what you do. But to your point, George, we spend a ton of time looking for people who are not looking for jobs. Because the very best people are doing well at their companies, they're being well treated, they're having a great time, and they're not looking. And some of the signals we look for are, in fact, things like, did somebody present at a conference? Did somebody, you know, publish something? Is there a blog? Do they have some presence that we can see? That gives us some sense of how capable this person is, because that's going to be a better indication than some random spam resume that comes in. So that's one of the things. The other thing is networking actually matters. We find that when people are referred into Google, they get hired at a much higher rate than people who just apply. And that's it's not because it's political and I can get my friend hired, because as I said, like we hiring managers can't make a hiring decision, right? It's because if you know somebody in the organization or know someone who knows someone and they pass you along, they've already done some pre-screening of you. And they've already said, you know what, I think Jim's going to be great for Google. And so I'm going to pass this person along. So that's, and you know, with things like LinkedIn and Google Plus where you can kind of plug into people's networks, it's easy to kind of find those connections these days.
Good plug for Google Plus.
Oh, did I do that? I didn't even notice that.
Are you looking for generalists, for flexible generalists, or for people with a very refined set of skills?
When the company was small, we looked exclusively for generalists. Now, a generalist would be a computer scientist who has done all kinds of computer science or who is open to any kind. As we've gotten bigger, we've gotten a little more thoughtful about it, and we instead look for a portfolio because we now understand generalists are great, but you actually need experts to solve some problems, right? Like a generalist is terrific, but I don't want the head of the tax department to be somebody who knows nothing about taxes, right? We get in a lot of trouble that way. And so depending on the group in the company, we try to leave it in a certain amount of people who are deep, deep, deep experts, but the majority are still kind of generalist problem solvers and people who have done a lot of different things in a given field.
So now your job doesn't start when somebody gets hired, right? Your department also works to integrate people into the company. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we're sort of soup to nuts. I mean, in a sense, cradle to grave because, you know,
hopefully
the maternity.
Hopefully not
literally. And, we'd love it if they were there the whole time.
It's cradle to eternal life, isn't it? Because you've got
exactly.
People working on longevity.
We'll just download them into robots. Yeah. But the job is sort of the care and feeding of the Googlers in terms of, you know, literally, but also, you know, their development, their emotional development, their professional development. So we've been doing a lot of work actually in the last year about how do you figure out how to make somebody more effective sooner when they join the company? Because the canonical problem is you put all this effort into hiring somebody, then they show up on day one and they're like, where's my desk? Where's my computer? Okay, I'm here, I'm excited, what do I do? And we found that, for example, there's some really, really obvious, simple things you can do. For example, have their manager actually show up the first day and say, hi, welcome to the company. I'm your manager. Introduce them to at least two people, like basic, basic things that most managers fail to do. And so what we started doing is anytime you have a new hire, you get a note the night before, an automated email. It says, please do the following five things tomorrow. You know, show up, introduce them to two people. And that causes people to become sort of fully effective 12% faster than if we did nothing. And it's a tiny, easy intervention. It's not rocket science, but it makes a huge difference. I mean, that gets somebody, you know, you get sort of 2 months almost more productivity, a month more productivity in a year. I mean, it's kind of astounding with such a small intervention.
I had heard once that new hires don't have perfectly defined roles right at the beginning. Is that true?
It's less true today. So in the non-technical areas, people get hired into pretty clear jobs. What we used to do in engineering is, as a software engineer, you'd get hired and you would join and you'd sort of be put on a team and we'd try you out for 6 weeks to 6 months and then you'd try something else. And you weren't at risk of being fired, it was just trying to find the best fit. What we learned is Some people actually like to know what their job's going to be before they get hired. And we also developed, as we got bigger again, this portfolio thing. So there's very specific needs we have in some areas. So in about probably two-thirds of the cases now, people know, two-thirds or more, exactly what the job's going to be. And the rest, we sort of try this, you know, try this job, now try this one, and see which one fits best for you.
George, is that the conventional approach? Do you find other companies are as thoughtful about integrating new hires?
So much depends on size. I mean, I think when you're small, there's enough human contact that's happening anyway. And in fact, one of the dividing lines I heard that struck me is recruiters would love to open up their own employees' LinkedIn profiles and say, let me scour everyone you know. Also, Google Plus profiles.
Thank you.
Yes, got to put that in. And they find in companies under 300 people, there's enough sense of shared buy-in that the feeling is, I want this company to succeed. I'm happy having you crawl through everyone I know. And companies over 300, it's like a gate came down, and the feeling is, you know what, these are my friends, these aren't the company's friends. So I think you've got a real challenge as you get bigger of how do you break down the walls, how do you bring people in, how do you have a sense of shared identity, and the more you can do there, the better. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're alone. I think you know most big companies are trying to do something similar as well. The ones mm-hmm. that don't end up finding their growth rates going to zero or negative.
Yeah. Well, there's this notion of Dunbar's number, which is, you know, you can really get to know intimately and keep track of about 150 people. And there's some debate about the rigor of that number, but, you know, if you think about, like, your Facebook friends or your personal circle, it's rare to find people who have a circle of intimates that is numbered in the 200 or 300 or 400. And so one of the things we spent a lot of time on over the last 4 or 5 years is how do you, you're never going to feel like a 200-person company when you have tens of thousands of people, but how do you create a sense of intimacy, and how do you fight the sense of anonymity that comes when you're bigger? And the conscientiousness I talked about plays into that, because conscientious people are going to care more about their environment, but we also try to do a lot of things to bring people together, and the orientations are part of it, and try to make little communities throughout the company, and then make it easy to connect the different communities. Because you can't make an enormous company feel like a 10-person company, but you can make it really easy to find people that you want to spend time with and enjoy and can help you, and you can help them. And we spent a lot of time on that. It's a really hard problem, actually.
Mm-hmm. Let me broach a perhaps sensitive topic, and I'll ask you both. How much do informal agreements between companies, competitors, or just companies in the same industry, informal agreements not to hire each other's employees, how much of a role does that play? In a company's hiring process?
I can tell you today it plays no role.
and historically in Silicon Valley?
Well, there's actually some litigation related to that going on, so and not to be flip, mm-hmm. so I actually can't speak to it. But the underlying principle is, you know, it's a free market and you should be able to hire whomever you want, and that's what Google's always tried to do.
George, the late Steve Jobs was, as we both know, he got apoplectic when other companies hired Apple employees, and now you've been studying this for years. You know, how much of a role do you think it played, the informal so-called no poach agreements? You know, how much did it play in the hiring ecosystem of Silicon Valley?
So there's a huge difference here between founders and executives who are hired in. I think founders regard anyone leaving as an enormous act of betrayal, and I've worked for enough different organizations that I can, you know, tell you firsthand that it's just very different. Hired managers, I mean, the CEO is every now and then going into the board and saying, you know what, I got this amazing offer, and I'm willing to stay, but you got to give me more equity. So I think they're really sort of two different value systems. Both can be successful. You can work in either world, but there's a sharp dividing point. I think it's hard for companies to stick to a no-poach ethos, even if they think they should, and I don't think they should. I think every now and then someone comes along who's that so good and so transformative and who wants to come work for you and to say, no, I don't want to improve my business because of some promise I made to my competitor. I mean, that's just tying you up in a pretzel. So, I've seen Wall Street is probably the most aggressive industry about poaching back and forth, and whole teams march and, you know, periodically suits are filed, but most states give people the right to move where they want to. So, we'll have to see how the litigation plays out. But I think anyone who thought they were building a lasting dam against labor movement was just plain wrong. People will move.
We're going to be taking your questions soon, so please start lining up at the microphone. And please remember that we are looking for one short and clever question each. And as we start to collect questions, let me ask you, Laszlo, last year, this year, many returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan. What role have you hired veterans? What role, can they play at Google? And are there particular, jobs where perhaps their experience in the military is not suitable?
As somebody who came to the States as a refugee and immigrant, I think, and as a Google executive, not only is it a great opportunity for Google to hire a lot of immensely talented people, but I think there's a bit of an obligation to sort of take care of those who've served this country. And by the way, that applies in different countries too, right? Other countries have veterans, and the right thing to do is when people serve their nations, you take care of them. So at Google, we actually do a lot of, we put a lot of effort into this area, and we do a lot of hiring. We have an internal Googler network of former veterans. And actually, it's a topical question. Over the last couple of weeks, I've probably myself spent, 10 or 15 hours on it. And I've been working with one veteran in particular who just got out of the Marines after 8 years. He was in their version of the Special Forces. Immensely talented guy. And the problem is, he's never had a corporate job, right? He went to college, was in Special Forces, was deployed, did all kinds of things that, to me, he's some kind of Superman. And he did in service to his country. And he comes out and went through the sort of transition program that the Marines offers. But he doesn't know what a marketing department is, right? And so we've spent a lot of time with him, just picking on him as an example, introducing him to people across Google. We had him come on campus and meet with a veteran, have lunch with a different group, talk to our head of leadership and talent. And we're trying to do this more and more and more because it's honestly, it's just the right thing to do.
I can't imagine a more stark transition than Iraq to the Googleplex.
Well, we have rotation programs where we annually, first of all, a lot of people come on campus to visit. So we've had, admirals and their staffs and joint chiefs of staff come to Google. And every year we probably host, 15 to 25 different military contingents for anywhere between a half day to 2 days. And we also have a number of rotation programs where people can get assigned to Google for a year while they're in active service. And we find sort of building all these networks out actually helps. But it's a little different from Afghanistan.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting How to Hire Like Google with George Anders, author of The Rare Find, and Laszlo Bock, Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google. I'm Brad Stone of Bloomberg Businessweek. Now let's go to audience questions. Sir.
Question for Laszlo. I got hired as an engineer at Google last summer, and I have a question about something that happened to me. I was asked to sign that I have read the employee handbook. However, there is no proper employee handbook at Google. There's no such object. There's a web page full of links that keep going. I asked a Google lawyer, where is the employee handbook? She said, and I quote from her email, "We have no PDF of the handbook. Sorry if that's not clear enough. This seems to suffice for 99.9% of our employee population. If it does not work for you, that's a decision you need to make, i.e. where you work." Do you think engineers should be required to lie on legal agreements?
No, I don't think engineers should be required to lie on legal agreements. That's a pretty easy question.
Yeah, because I confronted Larry Page about this at a TGIF last June, and in front, you know what TGIF is like, about half of Google is there networked in. He wouldn't even answer me. And he sent another Googler to talk to me, who also told me I should lie on something else.
Sir, are you still employed by Google?
I am not. I resigned after a week and a half because they would not change it.
No, actually, I remember the case.
Yes.
He sent a number of emails, and there's a number of fora where you can raise this. And if it is you, I don't recall the name.
Yeah.
The gentleman, basically, we have an email alias where there's 5,000-plus people subscribed, and there was an active discussion about it. I think I'm pretty confident saying the company position is you should not lie, ever.
One of your lawyers actually told me to, and I can tell you the exact quote if you want.
Well, I'd be happy to get those names
sure.
And look into it.
Okay,
sure.
Sir, thank you very much. Next question, please.
I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations for smaller companies trying to find people. I run a small software company, and it's not really about finding A players. It's about finding anybody that's qualified. We're not Google. We don't have people like pounding on our doors, and so I'm just wondering if you have any recommendations for smaller companies.
How wide is your geographic search? I mean, do they need to be within 10 miles of here, or can you?
Not necessarily.
Have people
work
remote?
Looking at outsourcing as well, but it would be nice if they were local-ish.
Yeah, I mean, outsourcing, I think, has taken on a more sophisticated tone than the days when it was, you know, India or bust. Outsourcing could be Santa Barbara, it could be Marin County. And I think if you start to look a little farther beyond the 415 and 650 area codes, the pool gets more interesting. And you're right, right now there's a bidding war for top talent here, and it can be hard for a small company to tap into the right people and to, you know, win a competitive auction. But I think geography would probably be your first tool.
I just add, I've honestly found LinkedIn to be a great source for that kind of thing because, I mean, everyone there by definition. There's also, I mean, I'm sure you know all the websites, dice.com, places like that. So that finding them is one piece. To attract them, there has to be something different about what you guys do that connects with those people, right? Because everyone's already, many people already will have a job today, so there has to be something distinctive and different. And I try to figure out what that is and convince people that that is real and meaningful. And, you know, that's worth more than money.
Hi, thanks for coming. And this question would be more for George. Years ago, I interviewed at Delta Airlines. It sounded like you had some dealings with different airlines. Question is, they were more interested in my marital status and had the weirdest setup in the room where I met with the shrink. They had a rocking chair, an overstuffed chair, and a hard chair. No one that I've ever spoken to, tell me what the thought process was behind that and that philosophy. What were they looking for? Please.
So I hate to pick on Delta, although I've flown enough Delta flights that I think I've earned the right. How are they doing as a business these days?
Well, at that time, they were the king of the crop.
Yeah,
at that time. This was 87-ish.
They've had a tough run since then. No, and there's a certain level of test, which I think, as Laszlo said, exists to make the interviewer feel powerful and in command rather than evaluate you. I don't know which one of these you're supposed to pick or how it would possibly tell you anything about what kind of person you're going to be. And I think in some cases employment law has caused people to get rid of some of the more eccentric and intrusive lines of questioning, and that's probably positive. In other cases, just common sense has caused people to get rid of some of these rather simple tests. I mean, Henry Ford used to, you know, put food in front of people, and if you salted it before tasting it, he decided you were impetuous and sent you packing, and the interview was over. You know, how does that correlate with anything? So, yeah, there'll always be eccentric tests, but I think over time, common sense wins out. And,
okay. Thank you very much.
I think the rocking chair is probably the right call.
I'm 23. I'm in my first job since graduating as an undergrad, a proud member of Generation Y, and I'm told that I'm expected to start job hopping any moment now. So I'm curious as to what, if anything, you do internally at Google to encourage people like myself to make a stronger commitment to the company. And then overall, if you think there'll be any effect going forward as you bring more of us in.
So as you can imagine, hire well over 1,000 people out of undergrad every single year, and often the number is much higher than that. And what we try to do is give them, I guess fundamentally, what I believe is as long as someone's learning and challenged, they're going to stick around. And so we try to constantly offer new learning opportunities. And that can be sort of a training. It can be, you know, each year we have thousands of speakers come on campus and give talks. It can be connecting with your peers. In fact, I think about 70% of our training at Google is actually led by Google employees, not a training department. So you can not only go to the training, you can actually also teach it. So we try to create as many different learning opportunities as we can, number one. Number two, one of the nice things, you know, as the company was growing, everyone said, oh, God, we're bigger, we're not the same. And one of the things that's beautiful about being bigger is you don't actually have to quit to get a different job. You can get promoted. You can go into a different function. You can work in a different country. I have someone on my team who she said, you know, her kids are, you know, around 7 and 9. She wants to live in the UK for a year, give them a European experience. We're going to send her to the UK for 2 years because her job can be done from there. It's good for her, good for the family, and it's going to cost us money, but she'll come back a better executive and better person. So it's those kinds of things, the learning and trying to create a lot of opportunities internally. And the result has been our attrition is basically the lowest it's been in 5 or 6 years. But we haven't hired you yet, so we don't know for sure if it would work.
Thank you.
Evening, gentlemen. So piggybacking off of what she asked and what you were saying, if I'm looking to, say, move from one department to another in my company, what is the best way to do that, and what recommendations would you give?
So get to know people in the department that interests you, whether it's, you know, come by and just ask them what they're working on, or, you know, what their department's like, if there's a chance to shadow there, if there's a way to meet them through some extracurricular company event, whether it's picnics, company sports teams, you know, dinners, what have you. And that'll also give you a chance to figure out, is this as interesting an area as I get closer to it as it is from a distance? Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes you realize that you were living with sort of an incorrect stereotype. But I'd say develop an interest back and forth gradually, and then, you know, they'll let you know, we like you. There's an opening coming up. Do you want to apply for it? Or, you know, it would be terrific if you could come work here. But the more you can build up those informal channels of communication, the better the fit's going to be. And particularly if you're not in a rush to move. I mean, sometimes things will open up 3-4 months down the road that may not be there right away.
What I would add is the problem with the way careers work is that the skills that are really important when you're in the middle and later part of your careers, which are kind of abstract reasoning, multitasking, as George talked about, the ability to solve kind of big, ambiguous problems, leadership, those skills aren't really valued by most companies early in your career, right? They don't want, you know, a new grad analyst to be thinking big strategic thoughts. They want you to do a spreadsheet at most companies. And so early in your career, the best way to create those different paths and options, and this is kind of depressing, it's just to be really, really, really good at what you do. And that way, when you do all the things George rightly recommends, it's not just, you know, you're connecting and schmoozing, but you also kind of have sort of this halo around you, which is, you know, Joe is this amazing performer, and everything he touches turns out really well, which will cause other departments to say, yeah, I'll take a chance on someone who's never done marketing.
Thank you. Hi. I run a software company with 35 people, and I have a question. When you need to make a hiring decision based on a matrix of competency and likability, you know, everybody wants to pick the A players, but you know, most of them go to, you know, Google or Facebook. So more companies are left with, and you know, everybody wants to avoid, you know, low performers with, you know, incompetent, unlikable people. So, I mean, those are left out. Now you're left out with, you know, either a competent jerk or incompetent, you know, of very, you know, people person, right? So, if you have to make a decision, which one do you think would be a better decision?
Oh, man. Is there a technical answer?
So I'm going to break your 2x2 matrix into a 3x3.
Okay.
There are people who are already competent. There are people who are about to become competent that haven't yet been recognized. And then there are people who will never become competent. And if you can't hire one, there's no reason to settle for three, but you may end up doing a lot of your hiring, picking up the people who are still finishing school and a semester before they might come on the job market, people who have migrated in from another field. I'm struck how many programs like Code for America are springing up that are taking bright people who haven't quite found their place in society yet and saying, we will give you very intensive coding instruction. And this is a well-paying job that you can come into without having a degree from the finest school. And some of them are turning out to do very well. So I would say look for people who have the drive, the desire, and are early in the inexperience curve so that you don't yet know what their upper potential is, particularly if you can hire them for project work and they work out well and you can extend them on, keep the good ones, slough off the ones who didn't turn out to be winners. But that may give you a middle zone where you're going to get what you need. You just have to do a little bit of the training yourself.
Yeah, and I would add, don't ever hire someone unlikable. And in all seriousness, because people like that are toxic, right? It's not just, they may deliver great results, but it will be harder to find people who want to work with them. The team around them will corrode, and they just have a horrible negative effect on the culture that in the States, in a lot of countries, where it's actually really hard to fire people, right? There's a lot of legal protections, and you know, there, some of them make sense, and you can debate the others. But the reality is it's hard to fire people, and you can't fire someone for being a jerk or not being likable. So once you get this person into your organization, they can be toxic, and it will either take a long time or be very expensive to get them out. And George's solution is really clever. I would wait and hire somebody with potential and bet on that rather than compromise and take somebody really good who's going to poison your company.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great question. Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm an industrial organizational psychology student, so a lot of the stuff that you guys talked about was fascinating. But also, I was a pilot for Southwest Airlines, not Delta.
I've had good experiences at Southwest.
Right, so you know, they're famous, as is Google, for their culture, company culture. And then I was also an Air Force pilot, too, another culture unto its own. But so for Google, can you talk a little bit about your leadership culture and if there's a certain type of leadership that you try to promote throughout the company, i.e. like transformational type leadership or something like that? And then, if so, is there a process that you go through as you grow leaders, where there's a sort of coaching or nurturing type of system that goes on?
Well, it's funny. The truth of the matter is, there's all kinds of leaders at Google, and we've got bad leaders too. Like in the prior gentleman's question, we've got some hiring mistakes to work out. The aspiration is that, as Eric Schmidt, our chairman, would say, the leader serves the team. And your job as a leader, as a manager, is to get the best out of them and to make their lives easier. It's not to direct. You know, occasionally you'll have to make a tough call where it's 50-50. But it's not to give orders. It's not to bark at people. It's to constantly think about how can you give them the freedom to make good decisions. And when they get stuck, how can you clear the roadblock for them? And if you've done that, then you're a terrific leader at Google.
Thank you. That's great.
Good evening. So the New York Times and The Economist tells us that only 22% of the graduates who've graduated since 2008 are in career positions. The rest of them are baristas in retail and working at Target. This is millions of young people. And yet we don't have enough people out here to fuel the growth of our companies. So do you have any ideas or thoughts about how we deal with that talent gap and kind of reclaim this generation of young people that aren't actually getting into good professional positions?
So one of the things I think we need to reconsider is, does that old advice of go to a good liberal arts college and get any major you want and the job market will be open to you, does that still hold? Accounting, finance, engineering, there are a handful of majors that tend to be pretty good pathways into the workforce. I managed to fool an employer with an economics degree, and by the time they realized the way economics is really taught, it's too late, you're already on the payroll. But I think we are entering in a world now where the classic, well-rounded liberal arts graduate is having a harder time, and I was talking with someone who advises a top Midwestern private school, and he said the university president was saying, I've got my most important hire of the year coming up. It's the new head of the career center, because they've got a whole lot of parents saying, I've been paying $40,000 a year to send my child here, and you know they're in the line to try and get a Starbucks job. What went wrong? So I think that's the first piece of the puzzle to solve. The other thing is, careers go upward, and it may be that your first year or two you're doing something that isn't enormously glorious. I have to tell a story out of school. My last visit to Google, I was hearing about all of the interns that come in and demand a private meeting with Larry Page or Sergey Brin because they know how to fix the algorithm. And they've been there 3 weeks. They haven't yet learned it. And I want to get Laszlo's thoughts of how you manage expectations where there are people who are newly minted graduates and believe that they can take on the biggest challenges without full training.
Yeah, I think my answer was not correct. I did not fix the algorithm when I joined. I think it's a real big challenge, and it's the right point. There was a study by McKinsey & Company that they shared at a conference the Atlantic put on where they talked about how if you look at what's going to happen with job creation, first of all, only a third of the people in the United States 20 years from now, a third will have a college degree, a third will have at best some college, and a third will have at best completed high school. So this is a structural problem around education. And there's a lot of countries in the world where vocational paths are sort of noble and well thought of, and actually having a career as a barista where you work your way up to managing the store, that's actually a noble, meaningful thing to do. And I think that is actually true. Being a craftsman, that is important work that has to get done, and I think that gets devalued often in conversation. I think also universities have an opportunity to be more transparent with their students about what the prospects are. you know, it's really hard as a 17 or 18-year-old kid to decide what you're going to be when you grow up. But it sure would be nice to know that, you know, and I'll make up the numbers, but if I study art history, I'm likely to make $20,000 a year. And if I study economics, I'm likely to make $50,000 a year. That would be really helpful to know before you spend $40,000 to $250,000 on an education. So I think there's some things that can be done, but I think it's a long-term structural issue.
Thank you, and I'm sorry to say we are out of time for questions, but we are asking all of our guests to answer one final question. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? And Laszlo, we will put you on the hot seat first.
Okay, that's fair. George has gone first on most of these. So I'm going to keep it kind of within topic. And it relates to why I actually got into HR as a field. I think for too many people, the experience of work is not a pleasant one. Work is a means to an end. I go to work because I need a paycheck and I got to pay the rent, and this is just my dumb job. And because of how our brains are wired, you kind of put up with it and have a, you know, work for 40 or 50 or, you know, now it's probably more like 60 or 70 years, and you live with it. And I think that's wrong. Part of what drew me to Google and a big part of why I do what I do is because I think work can be meaningful and it can be noble and it can be fulfilling. And I don't think you have to do everything Google does. Because the biggest thing Google does to make this happen is not give people free food and subsidize massages and all that stuff. You could take that away. The biggest thing Google does is give people freedom, give them something to believe in terms of mission that they're impacting the world, and then giving them a voice in how the company works. And I remember talking about this topic once with a group of folks, and somebody said, that's impossible. You know, we don't have Google's margins. We're a small company. We can't do that. And Jack DePeters, who's the CEO of Wegman Supermarket, it's a northeastern supermarket chain. They were rated the best company to work for before Google was. They are a grocery chain. I don't know their economics, but groceries have much lower margins, typically 1% or 2%. And their employees love working there, and they find meaning in their work, and they take care of their customers, and they love it. And it's not because they get free food. Free food at a grocery store would probably end badly. It's because there's a mission. And in any company, I think if there's a meaningful mission and some nobility in the work, and by the way, I mentioned, trades professions, there's meaning and nobility in that, right? Like someone I know worked, someone related to me, very close to me, worked as a motorcycle mechanic for years. That was great, meaningful work, and it mattered, and it made a difference. And I think if more companies and people thought about their work from that perspective, and if more managers thought about their environments as we're actually making a difference and let people have a little freedom and kind of improve what they're doing, I think work would not be, I got to do my 9-to-5. It would be something where everyone feels better about it and draws meaning and sustenance and energy from it.
George, save the world.
So I'm just going to sort of attach something to Laszlo's model that I think will help us both move our goals forward. I think we're on the brink of redefining what a full education means. I think the old model of, you know, go to college, go to graduate school, come out at age 22 or 25 with a degree that will serve you for the next 40 years is falling apart under, one, the pressure of rapidly changing job needs, and two, runaway cost situation. And we now have more student debt in America than we have credit card debt, which is kind of terrifying. It's partly because people have paid down their credit cards in the recession, but it's also because we're up to close to $1 trillion in student debt, including a lot of people who are just not going to be in a position to service that. And I think the answer is to move away from that, you know, 4 years of college, 3 years of graduate school model to something that becomes much more intermittent and sustained throughout your lifetime. And to find ways that people can enter professions with a year or two of post-college education and then come back 5 years later, 10 years later for a concentrated six-month series of courses, come back another 10 years after that to redefine what you do. Fields like engineering. I mean, to be a successful engineer for 40 years, you were doing very different stuff than your 40s and 50s than you were in your 20s. And we need to create an education system that caters to lifelong learning, rather than the sense that we can load up your brain once with everything you need, and then that's good enough to run for 40 years. I think it's also more fun, and it ties back to your point about making work sustainable and enjoyable. If you feel you're doing something different each decade, that's much better than doing the same thing again and again.
Great. Let's give a big round of applause to George Anders and Laszlo Bock. now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.